This is a 720 To Go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
You know what they say, when it's time to feed your head, Milt Rosenberg's got the biggest ladle.
We are tonight going to be talking with three Chicago policemen. They won't object to my calling them cops. They are Martin Pribe, Brendan Daugherty, and John Wrigley. Martin Pribe is the occasion for our, rather his new book is the occasion for our doing this program tonight. He's got a book about to be published, I've already read it, titled The Wagon and Other Stories from the City. He is an officer in the Chicago Police Department. Brendan Daugherty is the same, an officer in the Chicago Police Department, as is John Wrigley. When constabulary duties to be done, a policeman's lot is not a happy one. Would you agree with that sentiment? Or are there kicks and pleasures in the work?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of great fun, laughter, a lot of good friendships. It's often a hilarious job. It's also often very creative, and you make a lot of wonderful connections with people, and often get to help people too.
Does it sadden you to run into the amount of human misery, the amount of human disorder and distress, the amount of human violence and venality that inevitably a cop encounters?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Sometimes it's too much. Yeah.
What do you find too much? It's between the happy and the sad. What's on the sad side?
Well, on the sad side, it's you see children growing up. I mean, if you're assigned to a certain area for a long time, you see them grow up to go right into the gangs, follow the footsteps of their brothers, their parents. And it's, that part of it is very sad.
Your assignment regularly is on the west side?
It was, yes.
And you saw a lot of that there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can a cop turn a kid around occasionally? Save them?
I think it definitely happens in life. I think anyone can change, but I think it more has to do with the kid than it does the cop. And that kid has to be willing to change. The kid has to be willing, or has to have parents who are willing to want him to change. He has to have the support of his family, his support of the school, whatever school he goes to, the support of the community. Is the cop a part of that? Absolutely. But I think it has to do more with the kid than it does the cop. We have a job of being reactive to what the kid does, not proactive.
Martin Pribe started his professional life as an aspiring writer, worked for many years in various other occupations, and then decided, I'm going to become a policeman. That was as much for anything else as you needed a steady income.
Yes, I joined the police department because I needed a steady job. My interest was always at least half being a writer, and trying to make a living as a writer was not a good way to live, and I got tired of the, living on, lousy jobs, and so I thought, well, I'll become a cop, and it's a good way. It's been a good balance.
Your new book, which I might add is published by the University of Chicago Press. You may be the first working Chicago cop who's got a book published by UC Press. I'm not sure.
I don't know. That's possible. I don't know.
But typically, the authors are professors of archaeology or something.
Yes, it's more.
And it's a wonderful book. I've been reading it.
Oh, thank
the
you.
Wagon and Other Stories from the City. The first essay, The Wagon, appeared earlier in, I think, the Virginia Quarterly, wasn't it?
Yes.
And it's a solid and striking piece. And we find you there on your, I think, second day, or is it your first day on the police force, driving a wagon to go pick up a dead body.
Yes, that's actually in the first story, not the one that was in Virginia Quarterly. That's not important.
But doesn't matter.
Yeah, my second day on the job in the first district, they gave me a body bag, and they handed it to me, and I didn't even know what it was, and we had a removal, they're called. And that was my first removal, yes.
And you describe it in a way that absolutely horrified and chilled me.
Well, it didn't thrill me too much either.
Yeah, but, I wasn't sure I could even take reading it, let alone having gone through what you did. Tell what you did. What the situation was?
It was my second day, and there was a woman who had died in a high-rise right off Michigan, Wacker. I forget the exact address. And she was a woman who lived alone and lived in a small studio apartment. And it looked like, as I gather, she had drank too much and looked like she was a chronic drinker. She slipped and fell and hit her head. And it looks like she had struggled for a while because she had kind of wrapped herself up in the blankets. But she had died there and been left there 4 or 5 days. And when we got there, the detectives were still investigating it to determine that it was not a homicide. But we arrived right when they were finishing their investigation.
And from down at the far end of the hall, you're overwhelmed already by the stench, as you call it.
Yes, it was the first time I ever smelled a dead body that had decayed significantly. It was awful. It's an awful smell.
Did you get used to that sort of thing?
Nope.
Over the years?
I haven't. There's some wagon men I've met who are much more stoic about it than I am, and they seem more, more, I don't know what the word is, more, they're more able to deal with it. I mean, I deal with it, but it doesn't seem to bother them as much.
I think they've become accustomed to
it.
Yeah,
more accustomed to it.
Or they may have weaker olfactory receptors.
That never crossed my mind.
They may not smell as well or as effectively.
Well, I don't know if you ever get used to it.
No.
When we go down to the
You've
morgue.
You've all encountered that.
When we go down to the morgue, even the people in the morgue, they disguise the smell with some type of Vaseline they put underneath their nose or something, obviously. So I don't think it's something you ever get used to.
Yeah.
You may disguise it. You may try to hide it, but I don't think it's anything you absolutely get used to.
That, of course, was a corpse due to a sort of a natural but accidental death. You guys have all surely once or twice or maybe many more times encountered homicide and been called to the scene.
Yes.
Pretty much any cop on the street runs into a homicide every now and then, you know.
What was your most recent one?
The most recent one for me it's been quite a while. I have several that stick out in my memory, one being when I first got on the job in 1995, on the west side along Washington Street, about a 12-year-old was shot and killed during a gang war. And I had responded the way I would have responded because I was fresh on the police department. I was still in my civilian mode and got on there, and I was screaming into the radio for help and you know, asking for, you know, to block the streets off. And the child was dying. He was pretty much perishing at the time that we got there, and all the older policemen stood around looking at me like, you're wasting your time, you know. And to me it was that liminality right there that I was stuck between being a civilian and wanting to be a policeman.
I mean, their attitude was, the kid's going to die, so what? It happens.
Yeah, and he's caught up in the gang war. He's on the drug territory, and this is what happens. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think the one homicide that sticks on my mind, I just was at a scene of one last month, but this summer I was at one where it was a gentleman I had arrested a couple times, actually. He had sold marijuana on this block, and he was in a car with some of his friends, and there was an ongoing dispute over narcotics trade in this neighborhood. And I remember pulling up to the scene, got the call for shots fired, pulled up to the scene, and sure enough, there was someone in the back seat of this car that had been shot in the head. And I remember looking at this kid when I looked in, and I was like, I know him. This is someone I have arrested a couple times just for misdemeanor arrests.
A kid, how old would you get?
He was, I believe he was 18 years old when he died. And the friends that knew him on the block were visibly upset, and it kind of hits home to you when you know this person, you talk to this person on a regular basis, even as a cop on the street. You don't know him as well as his friends do on the block, but even in a position where I have arrested him a couple times, I knew of him. I knew him well enough where I recognize his face in the back seat of his car dying. So that's the one that sticks out of my mind recently, and that was about maybe 5 or 6 months ago that happened. But I think most of the homicides that we run across, we build up a wall so it doesn't bother us, so we can concentrate on it.
How do you do that? How do you inure yourself?
I think it's something that everyone approaches differently. I think it's something that you approach over time. I think you hear, maybe you hear about a cop having a weird sense of humor, or you know a cop who has a weird sense of humor. I think that's one way that cops deal with the death and the hardships on the street. I think everyone has their own way of how they deal with it, or how they build up a tolerance to it, so it doesn't bother them, so they don't take it home and affect the family that they're around after that.
You know, I'm suddenly having a thought of a parallel, a totally different profession, but not totally different because it also deals with a lot of death, is being a surgeon. I've talked to surgeons. I know surgeons. And they have sort of macabre humor, which they have to maintain to keep themselves distant from the fact that patients die on the table. That does happen rather often in surgery. And there's a kind of, I've even sat in or stood around and watched by invitation at some surgeries. And the running commentary while you got the body open and you're doing whatever you're doing, which is a complicated matter. I watched an intestinal operation. They were resectioning a colon. No easy thing, and it's a pretty messy thing. And this guy was saying, boy, that looks like a cute sauce, like a good sausage. What should we stuff it with? It was his macabre joke. And the nurses laughed, and all the while they're doing their serious work. Is there a parallel?
Yeah, there's definitely a parallel with that kind of humor. There's if people heard what they said, what we were saying, it might sound, you know, off the wall or cruel or something, but it is a way of dealing with it and keeps that distance from it. Definitely.
But we have to have it. We have to have it.
Well, the great question, of course, is what does being a cop do to people? And do they burn out? Some do burn out. And does it mess some of them up? Some do get messed up. We know all of that. And some do wonderfully well and have full, rich careers and manage to remain hearty and happy, more or less, through a long life. Yeah. What the difference is, you know, I'm a psychologist in real life, and to me the great question is, what kinds of personalities are suited to what kinds of professions? And I might press that on to you as an interesting matter of discussion. My three guests tonight are all working Chicago policemen, Martin Pribe, Brendan Dougherty, and John Wrigley. Martin Pribe is also the author of a very fine new book, The Wagon and Other Stories from the City. That's just about to be published, not yet officially published, by University of Chicago Press. Brendan Dougherty, let's get your locations done as well. Brendan Dougherty is an officer in the Chicago Police Department at the 24th District. That means Rogers Park.
I was there previous. Right now I'm assigned to police headquarters where I'm a gang analyst.
And going back to Martin, what is your assignment?
Well, I just started a foot patrol on Devon Avenue, but generally I was just a patrolman, general patrolman.
Gee, up and down Devon Avenue, you can get samosas and stuff like that.
I hope to. I haven't, you know, been there long enough to develop that part of it yet. But
I was at a great restaurant on Devon Avenue only last week.
Which one was
Tiffin?
Oh yeah, that is a good.
Have you seen it?
Yes. Yes.
And John Wrigley, what's your assignment?
I currently work in the 10th District, which is the Ogden District. It encompasses the Lawndale neighborhoods and the neighborhood of Little Village, or the Little Village neighborhood. And I am a tactical officer in that district.
That's pretty tough territory.
It can be at times. It's the west side of Chicago. It's predominantly poor, and there is a lot of violence generated from gang activity and also narcotic activity.
I was raising the question. I want to return to that. But I was raising the question before about burnout and some of the long-term negative consequences for some, clearly not for all cops. And I was trying to remember the name of the author of The Onion Field, and Martin helped me. It's Joseph Wambaugh. He was on this program once, and I read that book, and I saw the film as well. And it's about a cop who's a good cop and enjoys it, but his family kind of has fallen apart, so he's a loner. And he ends by a surprising suicide. There's just nothing else to do. That's a horrible ending, yet I suppose it's not totally untrue to some lives.
Yeah, that's true. Police officers kind of an intensified life a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's life, you know, kind of on an edge for in some ways, but obviously for some cops more than others. I mean, John is on the west side, and Brendan worked the west side for a long time. It's much busier, much rougher out there than where I work. So, but yeah, it is kind of life on the edge. You see people in extreme conditions, and people feed off that, and I think a lot of officers get to enjoy that.
And then when it's gone,
life can seem a little boring.
I suppose.
You get put into a vacuum back in the society, and you've lived in this intense lifestyle for, you know, for most policemen, 25 to 30 years. I've lost two friends to suicide.
Yeah. You have, really?
Yeah. Both with families.
Both retired policemen?
No, young policemen.
Young?
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of, you know, the older policemen, I believe, in my opinion, were fortunate enough to have a society that kind of let them do their thing. And they weren't as viewed as harshly as I think we are today, under the camera, so to speak.
You better explain that.
Well,
sounds important. I want to know what
okay,
you mean.
Okay. Well, we're under the camera on our own, in our own squad cars. We're under cameras from security cameras. We're under cameras from the media. We're under cameras from cell phones.
Hold on. In your own cars. You mean back at headquarters, they're watching you doing your work in the car?
No, the officer uploads the video themselves to headquarters.
Uh-huh.
If that's the proper if that's the channel where it ends up. But yes, the squad car goes into the station, uploads the video for the evening at the station.
There's cameras in the cars.
Yeah. Were the cameras focused on the cop or focused on...
Both.
Mm-hmm. So everything you've done is on visual record.
Yes.
Visual and auditory record.
Yes. If
I didn't
yes.
know that.
Yeah. It's, I think, 24 where Marty works is one of the pilot program districts where they put him in about, yeah. what, about two, maybe 2 years ago?
Yes, I actually have a chapter in the book about cameras in the car,
yeah.
how it's transformed the job quite a bit and made it a lot more difficult, a lot more complicated in some ways. And
you're worried about how it's going to look to your supervisors, whatever it is.
What, to everyone?
Yeah, people can draw all kinds of... you know, conclusions or interpretations mm-hmm. that may or may not be, might more reflect their bias or their own prejudgments about what's going on.
You and know. You've got both reporters and, I suppose, lawyers who are potentially on your back. Is that it?
Yeah, I would say that police work and, anyone who works in government, obviously, is scrutinized these days. I think a lot of people who enjoy catching police officers not doing everything the right way, welcome the cameras in the car. At the same time, they were introduced to us as protecting the police officers because people who will make a complaint that isn't true and the camera shows something that is different than what they're saying, obviously that works in our favor. But at the same time, if your actions are recorded on the job, I'm sure there's going to be something somebody will find and say, well, that also didn't do this right, he should be punished for it. Anybody who would be under a camera doing his job is going to have this fear that he's doing something that somebody's going to interpret as wrong or interpret as not necessarily what should be done. That's an extra burden to carry these days for officers who are on the camera. Definitely. I think that's something that, as Brenda said, older officers didn't have to worry about. And just the liability by itself. I mean, I think officers are sued much more frequent these days than they ever have been in the past.
Sued by people that they've arrested?
By people they arrested, people they encounter, people who just...
don't like the police.
Don't like the police, yes. I think...
Has that happened to you?
Yes, I've been sued.
For what?
I'll give you one general story. I recently... My last lawsuit was by someone who I put away for 15 years for selling narcotics and having a gun on him. He is serving an IDOC right now. He filed a $7.5 million suit against myself, the other officers in the city, for basically unlawful arrest. Huh. And that is in the legal system, in the federal court system right now. They were allowed to do that while they served time in IDOC. They were provided the paperwork through lawyers that they can fill out themselves and sue.
I trust the city is providing you with proper legal counsel.
That's true. We are indemnified by the city, and they do provide us a counsel, obviously, because the city is under liability for that.
Does this happen to most cops these days?
Yes.
Really?
Any hardworking cop.
You've been sued as well, Martin?
No, I haven't yet, but I'm...
Yes, I have. I haven't been sued. I've been a witness on a lawsuit. Like Wrigley said, you know, it just... There's money there, and the lawyers need work, and so they're going to seek out where they can find the money.
You know, I'm aware of something else that must be a real burden. You know that in real life, I am, or I was until I recently retired from it, a professor at the University of Chicago. A long time ago, in 1965, I remember the 1968 riots in front of the Conrad Hilton during the Democratic Convention. And I remember, and I remember that Dan Walker, who was then a business executive, later became governor of the state, classified that as a, quote, police riot. And I remember, you know about that. You were too young.
Yes. No, I was alive during that. As a matter of fact, I live right down the street. So.
And in succeeding years, one often heard in Chicago cops being called pigs. And the off the pigs was a common line. Indeed, the Black Panthers sort of... One of the leaders of the Black Panthers wrote someplace that he was the one who decided they must have an animal name. Pigs is the right name to show our real contempt for them. And that's still, you may still encounter that sort of verbiage. I don't know.
It's a little more vulgar. Yeah.
More
vulgar
than that.
Yeah. Now it's to our face now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gang members have absolutely no respect at this current time. None.
And so do you have to simply take
well,
that?
What are you going to arrest them for? For calling me a name?
For
doing that in front of the judge, the judge is going to look at me like, well, you're a cop. Take it.
Uh-huh.
It's true. They can pretty much say what they want.
I think the theory among lawyers and judges is, as a police officer, that just goes along with the territory. We can't be a victim of the state law of disorderly conduct, which is basically getting into somebody's face and disturbing their peace.
But disorderly conduct is... classifies as a misdemeanor, doesn't
it? That is a misdemeanor charge. And we as police officers, and it's been ruled that we cannot be victims of that, it goes along with the territory. In other words, we have to take
it. It's not a misdemeanor if you call a cop as many dirty words as you can think of.
There's no crime against that whatsoever.
Freedom of speech.
But if they call me that on the street,
it's
a misdemeanor?
They could be arrested.
You could call us and we'd have to lock them up.
Huh.
Yeah.
Strange.
Well, and that's how we feel about it, too. You know?
Yeah, that needs to be pondered further. And we return to Martin Pribe. And to Brendan Dougherty and John Wrigley. Let's talk about typical days. You can blend a number of days together if you want, but you're in the car on patrol. You get a call. You get various calls. What pops up in a typical day?
Common calls are domestic batteries or domestic disputes, car accidents, suspicious cars, people, gang fights, gang activity. Those are all pretty common calls.
Might all of that come in one day?
Oh, sure, definitely, yeah. Yeah, you might have one day where you get 15 calls, or you might have one day where you only get two or three.
So. I had a friend years ago, we were on some project together, named Morton Bard. He was a professor of psychology at City College, but he was also attached to the police department. He earlier had been a working cop before he got his doctorate and went into this kind of work, and he did a lot of studies about... police problems and police psychology, so to speak. He asserted constantly that the most dangerous thing, the thing the cops are most afraid of, is domestic calls. That you literally are more in physical danger there than you are on the street.
That's true. You know, people are so pumped up emotionally and
take us to one troubled apartment.
What common domestic battery call will be, an argument over property or somebody didn't pay their share of the rent or...
The drunk boyfriend returns.
The drunk boyfriend returns and won't leave. And when you get there, one of the parties is usually very upset. And, you have to establish whether a crime was committed, whether there was an actual battery. If there was an actual battery, you have to take action. You have to arrest them, and it's a good idea to arrest them because you don't want to leave, and they'll come back, and somebody gets seriously injured or killed. So,
is there a danger of battery directed against you before you die?
Yes, yes. A lot of times people will say, they'll give you a hint that they're going to fight and say, I can't go back to jail, or I'm not going back to jail, or, you know, they'll give you clues that they're going to fight you and that they're going to refuse. And then that's a very dangerous situation.
And you're in their house.
And you're in their house, yeah. You don't know where the weapons are. You don't know if they're on parole or, you know, if they're criminals.
Brandon, you've had such experience.
Sure.
Give me one and how you handled it.
I went to one where the husband was on drugs on the west side, and when we got there, he was completely naked, completely sweating, profusely sweating. He had been smoking PCP, and that turned into just a complete brawl. You know, it went from... You know, attempting to handcuff and falling over tables and knocking everything over. The wife is screaming at us because now it looks like we're beating him up when we're just trying to get him handcuffed. And now the kids are crying and because the police are in there and it's, you know, there's a fight now in the living room. You're calling for help. And usually the help arrives when everything's settling down. And then it's off to jail and you got to go into the station, calm down, do your paperwork. And you do it right.
I think when you enter into these situations, you're entering into desperate situations. A lot of the people in these situations look at this as the end of their relationship possibility, the end of their life. So you're going into very desperate situations, a lot of the calls that our SWAT team gets called out on, hostage situations or domestic disputes where they've barricaded themselves into their apartments. Because they see it as a desperate situation. Recently, we had one a couple months ago in my district where a gentleman barricaded himself in there with his girlfriend or wife. I don't remember which. And it was a standoff for 6 to 8 hours. Eventually, the SWAT team made an entry. He started setting the place on fire. I think those are dangerous situations because they're desperate situations. Or the people we're encountering look at them as desperate situations, possibly the end of their relationship or the end of the life as they know it at that point in time.
And Brandon made a good point, is that a lot of times when you go to a domestic, say the woman is the complainant, when you have to take action against the husband and start to use force to arrest him because he's resisting, she'll suddenly switch and turn on the cops. So you'll have, if you have your back turned, and next thing you know, she's jumping on you when you're jumping on her husband, and she's the one who called you. So it can get pretty absurd. I think every cop has experienced that a few times.
No, they're aware of it, yes.
Yeah, they're aware of it. You always remember the complainant can turn to the offender real quick, too.
In a situation like that, do you face the possibility of having a gun or a knife pulled on you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you got to watch everybody's hands very carefully, yeah.
And it's happened.
Oh, yes. Yes. All you have to do is, there's a website called the Law Enforcement Memorial, and it lists the story of every police officer who's been killed in the line of duty in the United States. And you could find, like, one out of every five stories is so-and-so officer walking into a domestic dispute, was shot and killed, or ambushed by whoever. And it happens all the time, unfortunately.
A soldier's life, if you're in battle, or potential battle, does feature the knowledge, my God, I could get killed doing this. Is that in the minds of cops?
Yes, I think so. You're reminded of it, you know, every now and then, too frequently, officers are killed on the job, and of course, we all read about it and feel awful, and if it reminds you, you know,
And they pound that when you're going through the training academy. They pound that over and over every single day, that every job you take has the potentiality to be your last job.
We had that cop TV show, I forget what its name was, but the briefing sergeant in the morning ends his briefing always with "Stay safe out there."
Was that Hill Street Blues?
Hill Street Blues, it was.
I think every officer is aware that a situation may be dangerous, but you cannot approach the job thinking that something's going to happen. You have to approach a job with a confidence that I am going to walk into this situation, I am going to solve whatever problem is here, and I am going to be in control. If you don't have that attitude going into those situations, you're going to have a rough time solving the problem. You're going to have a rough time getting control.
So that gets to the psychologist question I was adverting to earlier. What kinds of guys make really good cops? Cops on the beat.
I think that's a tough question.
I'd say the single guys.
Yeah. This is I think police work is a very complicated job, more complicated than people think. It's nothing. It's not a job you understand unless you actually do it. My father was a police officer, but I had no idea what police work was until I actually got into it, and that's the truth. I saw it from the side of when he came home. But I didn't know what was involved in it until I actually did it. Actually, I didn't know what was involved in it until probably 4 to 5 years into police work. It's a very complicated job. It takes a while for you to learn how to deal with the things you have to deal with. The public and how to relate to the public and relate to people on and off the job. It's a very complicated job. And it takes a complicated individual who is willing to be able to keep things in perspective very well. To simply answer what kind of person, I don't know if that is a simple answer.
Then is the term dumb cop self-contradictory and impossible? Can you not be dumb and be a cop?
Well,
you know,
to do your job even adequately, you have to be able to think creatively and you have to think your way through things. But, you know, and it like, Rick John said it's a complicated job, so different people bring different skills to it. I mean, some people are really good talkers. Some people are really good at using their body, you know, and fighting, and other people are good at, you know, talking on domestics or whatnot. So, I mean, it's good to be well-rounded, but everybody has their strengths. But, you know, I learning how to be a cop, I didn't know what it was like either when I got out on the street, but it did strike me that learning how to be a cop is much like learning how to develop a style as a writer. And that is a jazz musician friend of mine said, I think it's imitate, assimilate, and originate. And you spend your first few years on the job just, you know, going to all these calls and watching all these cops handle it. And then you try and you observe the cops who you think are good, just like you find your favorite writers and you find yourself imitating their kind of writing, and until you pick and choose the styles that you like the most, and then you start adopting them, and pretty soon you develop your own style of doing things. I think every cop has their own style. Wouldn't you guys say so?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I think every cop develops his own style, his own way of dealing with the job and the public.
And some cops don't like, you know, your style. Some cops do very differently. You can't ride together very well because you're just too contradictory in your styles. It doesn't mean one's right or the other one's right. It's just different ways of looking at things.
Have you had that experience?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about an incompatible partner. What was incompatible between the two?
Well, let me get this list out here. No, I'm just kidding. I'm probably on most people's list. I'd have to think about that. I don't like partners who don't listen, you know, to when people are saying things. I tend to not preach a lot at people, so partners who preach a lot, I'm a little uncomfortable with that. But
or you get the crabby cop who's always
yeah,
crabby,
always angry, you know, always everything's negative. You know, I like somebody who likes to have a lot of fun and laugh a lot. And if I can't crack jokes and stuff, I find that a unpleasant tour. But that's about it.
Yeah, I've worked with a lot of people over the years, and I've had some absolutely outstanding individuals, and I've had some not so outstanding individuals. And you know, there's one great thing is that your watch commander, the man who's in charge of your entire watch, your captain or your lieutenant. Marty's done it before, I know that. I'm sure John has. Is that if you have a bad partner, you have the blessing of walking right in there and say, I can't work with this person tonight. And they're accommodating. They're absolutely accommodating.
I was approaching this building at the lower level once, a number of years ago, in my car. And I made a right turn around the back of the parking lot, heading towards the parking lot. And And there was a police car there, and the guy hailed me, and it turned out to be a captain or a lieutenant. He was there for other more important reasons, but he decided that he would ticket me for making the right turn without fully stopping. I guess that was it. Mm-hmm. There were no other cars around. And then he noted that I wasn't wearing a seatbelt. And at that point, a regular police car came by, and he hailed this guy. He said, write this guy up for an improper right turn and for a seatbelt violation. Okay. And he dashed on his way. Maybe he had a driver in his own car. I don't know. He had the gold braid on his cap. And when he was gone, the cop who had been called and said to me, don't worry about it. Forget it.
Well, that's probably how I would handle it, too. Yeah.
Is that so?
Yeah. Sure. I think, like it's.
But if you were a captain, would you be insisting on ticketing me?
No, you know, I obviously wasn't at this situation. I don't know the captain, but
I don't either.
I think sometimes, especially in this city, I think people run across a police officer who may just be having a bad day. And is it true you weren't wearing your seatbelt? Maybe. Is it true that it's against the law? Maybe. And maybe should he let that slide? Maybe. But I mean. Maybe he was just having a bad day, and the fact that you did that.
Well, I was a bad citizen. I should have had my seatbelt on.
He wanted to make a point of it. I think a lot of times police officers, and it's happened to us, to me, and I'm sure Marty and Brandon, where we carry our emotions into this job on a particular day. And when we encounter someone or a public, those emotions may come through, and that anger may be there. And I think a lot of times the public forgets, and even we forget that we're humans. And sometimes that emotion does come through in our daily work.
We're late for some commercials. We'll pause for those. I plant this question with you. It's a cliche, but it's a cliche that brings out good stuff sometimes. What was the best and the worst? The best experience you ever had as a cop, the worst you ever had as a cop. It was the best of days, it was the worst of days. Sounds like the beginning of a novel by Dickens. There are probably many good days and many bad days, but choose one. John Wrigley.
I would say one of the worst days I've had is, I remember when I first became a police officer, I was actually a deputy sheriff in a small town, central Illinois, called Decatur, Illinois. That's where I began my career. I responded to a scene of an accident, and... It was a van with a family, approximately four children and a mother and a father, and not everyone survived that crash. And I
all dead?
Not all of them, no. I pulled out a five-year-old child and laid him basically in a cornfield and waited for an ambulance to show up. Uh-huh. That was one of the images that still pop in my mind even today. It was the first time that I saw a traumatic incident right after it happened, and I just remember the face of the child all bloody and unconscious and basically dying while I sat and watched. I would say that was one of the worst days and one of the first times I saw it too. A best day for me is when it appears anyway that I affect somebody in a positive way to where what I did help them solve the problem they had, or for the first time in their life, they realize that maybe I should turn my life around because of the actions of this officer. Those are the best days when you think you're making a difference.
Martin Prime.
I would say the worst thing that was one that really bothered me was a woman who was retired from a government job. I think a postal worker. She had this beautiful condo on the lake, but she had had a brain tumor removed and had some lingering effects from it. And her daughter was a drug addict and had three or four kids and had moved in with her and turned her house into, you know, a filthy kind of a pit and took advantage of her mother and stole her money and would often try and have her mother committed to the mental hospital for evaluation for 48 hours so she could get the house to herself for 2 days to be with her boyfriend and do drugs. And it was just so particularly cruel and abusive and unnatural to do that to your mother that bothered me quite a bit. And the best thing...
Hold on. What did you do on the scene?
The mother wouldn't really allege any criminal activity against the daughter, so I had trouble laying a foundation of a crime, even though I tried to work it. And I figured the best thing for me to do was, because she was displaying some symptoms of mental illness, to have take her to the hospital. Uh-huh. And then I wrote a long report to senior services to have an investigation conducted into the nature of the house.
Well, that seems like the wise way to handle it, yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't think of anything else.
And the best day?
I would just say the best thing about the job, the best day would be any day you have a partner who you like quite a bit, and you're doing your job well, and you're moving about the district and seeing how it works, and, you know, have very good conversations in the car along with doing your job well. That's always a lot of fun, a good feeling.
A nice lunch.
And a good 2-hour lunch if I can swing it. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, cops at table is a kind of an urban scene in itself. And cops seem to enjoy sitting around and talking while they're having their coffee or having lunch or whatever. That is, they're trading stories, just as we're sort of doing now.
Correct. One of the stories that sits with me today, that I carry it with me, and I don't think I'll ever let it go. It wasn't that traumatic. It wasn't for me. But what had happened was I was working alone, and I responded to a child abuse call. And when I met the mother, and she explained to me that, you know, everything was okay, you know, nothing's really going on anymore. You know, my daughter was, you know, back talking to me a little bit. So by law, I have to check on the daughter. So I walked into the kitchen, and the daughter was sitting in her underwear. She was probably about 8 or 9 years old, and she had tears coming down her eyes, but she wasn't crying, and she was doing her homework. But she wasn't doing her homework. She was just scribbling over paper over and over. And her mother had beaten her so bad with the belt that you could actually see the outline of the belt all through her back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it bothered me so much because the mother found it to be an okay thing, and I said to her, you know, you're going to go to jail. You know, I'm going to arrest you. You know, we're going to take care of your daughter. But I said, if I take my belt off right now and I beat you with it, I'm going to go to jail. And I'm going to go to jail for a long time. You're not going to get anything. You know, and sure enough, we went to court, and, you know, I prosecuted her the best I could. And she got, you know, family parenting classes.
Mm-hmm.
And got her daughter back, I'm sure. So that was one that just bugged me a lot.
Still bugs you, apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
Gentlemen, let's talk about Chicago gangs. When we were off the air just now, Martin was telling me about it. I was asking you, what are you running into now that you've got a new duty, which is actually foot patrol on Devon Avenue. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And we talked about it earlier. I mentioned a new Indian restaurant I had found there. But you told me it's a heavily drug-infested area.
Well, I mean, there's drug and gang activity up there. There's a lot going up on Devon, but that's one thing that's going on up there, yes.
People pushing drugs?
Yes.
Buying and selling?
Yes.
And gangs competing?
Yes.
Competing how? Shooting each other?
Well, we haven't had a lot of shootings up there recently. I think last summer we had some. I'm not sure, but there have been shootings up there, but not recently.
Small Stripes, the Black Peystone Nation, as they're called, has east of Western Avenue, and the Latin Kings control west of Western Avenue.
So it's territorial?
Yes. It's strictly territorial, absolutely.
And there are sort of agreements between the gangs?
There are agreements between the gangs, yes.
Yeah, I think violence, a lot of the violence in Chicago is gang-related, obviously. And narcotic related. That's
well, the gangs are in the narcotic business.
That's basically how they make their money. Absolutely. That's why it's important that we, as police officers, get a handle on the narcotic activity and almost put pressure on these narcotic actors where they don't make too much money, so that violence doesn't get out of hand, so they don't end up shooting over a territory
so
that makes a lot of money.
So what's the real attitude? What are you saying? That we learn we got to tolerate this so long as we can keep it nonviolent?
No, I don't think toleration is the answer whatsoever. I don't know. You know, it's a complex problem how we got to this point, and I don't know what the solution as far as now at this point and all of a sudden it's going to decrease. I think the only way I know how to handle it is to put pressure on the people who sell narcotics and to put pressure on the gangs who distribute and bring the narcotics into Chicago through channels. That's the only way I know.
But looking towards what kind of ultimate objective? To eliminate the narcotics trade and to disestablish the gangs? Or is that just an impossible
We can't tolerate the gangs. I'm father of three. Absolutely not. No, I've been on the job for over 15 years.
Can you see a way from here to there? There being getting rid of the gangs?
Let the police handle it. Let the police handle it. That's it.
Lock them up.
All of them.
Well, if they break the law, lock up. Give them meaningful
sentences.
But
we need to have laws that are going to back the policemen up when they do their jobs. And we're going to need people to understand that what may look offensive, what the policemen are doing is not always offensive. And we need support. We need community support.
And you're not getting enough, is what you're saying.
Absolutely not. No.
Where do you lack support?
I, as a veteran officer, am going to say citywide.
But, I mean, in what ways does support fail you?
What way does support fail us? You know, I don't think we have the backing, again, from the judges, the juries, absolutely not. The state's attorneys will tell you that.
You can make an arrest, but it doesn't follow through.
It doesn't follow through. No, it doesn't hold water. Right.
Yeah. Part of it is the system of Cook County and Chicago. It's the system is flooded with cases. And I don't know what the solution is as far as which cases do we weed out. We don't have the money to prosecute these people. We don't have the money to lock up everyone who needs to be locked up. So, the state's attorneys, the judges, the police department, they're doing the best job they can with the resources they have. But we just don't have the money or the resources to probably prosecute everyone we need to prosecute in Cook County. The system is just too big. It's too flooded with cases.
Have you ever encountered an organization known as the ACLU?
Luckily, no.
not formally, no.
They're not particularly active in this area, then.
I haven't directly dealt with the ACLU. I just read about them. I know of a few cases they've gotten involved. But no details whatsoever like that. So
who's protecting the gangs if it isn't outfits like the ACLU who are over scrupulous, possibly with concern for the rights of the arrested? Who then is getting in the way of the proper administration of serious justice?
Well, I don't necessarily think that they're protected. It's just we don't have the resources to deal with it. The problem is so big. We don't have enough police officers.
You need more cops to begin with.
We don't have enough police officers to deal with as many gang members as there are. The mentality of a gang member is basically they do not value life. They don't value their own life. They don't care if they live or die tomorrow as long as the objective of the gang, which is basically making money, is met.
And many of them do die tomorrow.
Oh, yes. And they're not afraid of that. And they'll tell you they're not afraid to die.
And you know, when one gets killed, I'll say this. I've seen this over and over and over. One gets killed, they mourn his death for about a week. And yeah. I'm not kidding you. You never hear about that dead person ever again. They don't talk about it. They don't. It's gone, and it's on to the next guy.
I guess the only thing I'd add is that one thing I've kind of amazed me since being a cop is that criminals do have extraordinary rights, and to prosecute somebody is a very cumbersome, complicated process, and it's filled with legal challenges, and you know. I spent 2 days on a witness stand, you know, arguing whether I Mirandized this guy, and I wrote that I had Mirandized him, but, you know, a whole trial boiled down for 2 days on this one small issue of the trial. So
what was the charge? It had nothing to do with the arrest.
He was a repeat felon possession of a firearm, and it just, you know,
Was he convicted?
He was, but it was close. It could have gone either way. And, you know, it's just, criminals do enjoy extraordinary rights, and I believe in individual rights, of course, but it, at some points it does seem to get just utterly absurd. You know, the motions and the alternate theories and it's just to prosecute somebody for a simple offense, you know. And it's hard to get full sentences on them, too. Would you agree with that?
No, especially in Cook County, where the system is so bogged down with so many cases. I came from smaller systems where it was much easier to prosecute individuals who had drug offenses or weapon offenses because their systems aren't bogged down. They don't have to weed through the worst of the worst to say, okay, well, we're going to prosecute this case, but we'll let this one go.
You mean here, not only are there not enough cops, but the courts are too overloaded and the jails are too
There's
overloaded.
Not enough judges. There's not enough state's attorneys. Yeah. There's not enough room in the jails. And
corrections
I know,
officers.
Yeah, there's not enough correction officers. And I know the population of the jail has gone down, But I think the sheriff does a very good job of organizing that, that department. But I don't think that's necessarily an indication that more people don't need to be in jail for doing what they're doing.
What are the big gangs in Chicago right now? What gangs are giving you serious work to do?
In the neighborhood I work in, the biggest gangs are the Vice Lords, Gangster Disciples, the Latin Kings, and another Latino gang called the 2-6. And basically, they're involved in drugs and guns.
Yeah.
Yeah, citywide, it's I think we're going to narrow everything down to Gangster Disciples, Latin Kings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They would know better than I do. They've worked more with the gangs than I have.
My guests tonight are all working Chicago cops. Martin Pribe is a special one in that he's also a published author, and he's published a book that is very strongly commended. I've been reading it and enjoying it and learning a great deal from it. It is titled The Wagon and Other Stories from the City. Not actually officially published yet, but the publisher is the University of Chicago Press. And I think, Martin, you are the first working Chicago policeman to be published by the UC Press, which usually has philosophers and semanticists and chemists and Lord and theologians writing for them. Brendan Dougherty is another officer in the Chicago Police Department presently. It says you're at the 24th District, Rogers Park, but that's been changed more recently, you said.
Correct. Right now I'm working at police headquarters as a gang analyst for Area 3, which is the north side of Chicago.
And John Wrigley is with the department in the 10th District Tactical Unit. We go directly to the phones on 312-591-7200, and Tony has reached us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Hello?
Troy, I got that wrong. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, Troy. Great show. I'm a cop, and I just wanted to comment. Whoever said that, you know, it's a good 4 or 5 years before, you know, they really felt like they knew what they were doing on the job, and that is so true, and I don't think people really understand that. I grew up in a cop family, and you still don't get it until you start doing it, and you realize that it's years before you feel really comfortable, you know, at work, and you feel like you can be in situations and you know what to do, and people always understand about how complicated this job can be, because the mechanics of it seem simple. Find bad guy, arrest him. But it's not that simple.
Mm-hmm.
You feel fulfilled by your work. You're not unhappy being there.
No, I love it. I love it. This is absolutely the best job in the world. I couldn't imagine doing anything else.
What do you really love about it?
Every day is different.
Yeah.
I like being out and doing things. I could never sit behind a desk and, you know, be at a computer screen, although I have a computer screen in my car. and it's a fun job. I mean, it's fun. I mean, going out and dealing with people and arresting people and taking them to jail and just all that, it's exciting and it's fun and it's dramatic, and sometimes it's boring and sometimes it's more exciting than you want. But
does Troy speak for you three guys, do you think?
Sure.
When he stresses that.
Yes.
It's the variety, the adventurousness of it.
He's right. Every day is different. And it sounds like he has a good attitude, and that's the most important thing. You got to have a sense of humor, and you got to keep everything in perspective and approach it in a fun way, even though it's not always fun.
So we thank you for adding that note. Very valuable contribution.
Thank you.
And on to Lisa at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Good evening. And I've got to thank with the wonderful work, the safety that the officers provide.
Thank you.
There's a juxtaposition between the emergency room, where I've been a nurse, the emergency department, and often there are police there, so that's where I've gotten to know most of the ones I know. But there's also when a perpetrator, it might be a young gang member, is at one minute he's a perpetrator, and then when he's brought to the emergency room, to us he's just a patient.
Right.
And our folk, you know, we have two different goals, and we kind of bump into each other sometime. I was wondering, how are you trained? What are you guys thinking? What are you told as far as where you go, how far you go to get your report done in the emergency room.
How far we go is in...
We often want to maybe uncuff them.
Right.
The person gets so agitated. I don't have a gun. I'm 5 feet tall, 100 pounds.
Right.
And I find it often easier, and most of us do, to kind of get it stand outside, be out of vision maybe. But the newer ones, they don't want to do that.
Right.
So are you trained?
Well, the protocol, it's a protocol. It's the officer's call himself. But the protocol would be if the subject's under arrest, unless he's unconscious, that handcuff, in my own opinion, stays on.
Yeah, I think it depends. It depends on the situation. I mean, obviously, someone who's fighting for his life is not going to fight the nurses and the doctors or the cops who's there. It depends on the situation. I think most cops try to stay out of the way of nurses and doctors when they're attending to a patient, and we understand that their first priority is to keep that patient alive no matter how we view this person or what he has done.
Or we may even have a history with that person.
Absolutely.
That's in the hospital.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But
they have like a conditioned response to the uniform.
Sure.
Kind of plays to a negative for us sometimes.
I'm very glad that you called and brought that up to us, because I sometimes always wondered if you guys saw it that way, and I'm glad you said this.
I mean, it's a little area that I think we bump into each other sometimes, and I'm just, yeah, but oh my God, what you guys do. Wouldn't do it for a night, I don't think.
I work the wagon for a long time, so we take a lot of prisoners from the lockup to the hospitals, and
right.
I have to say that a lot of times when guys are charged with felonies and they know they're going to not get out that night, they're going to go to the county jail, they feign illness so they can go to the hospital and get a bed with a TV, and then they try and get some painkillers or whatnot. So, a lot of the hospital staff is really keen to that. And,
oh, yeah.
And, but a lot of, maybe some new nurses or even new cops or new staff don't pick up on it. And they, sometimes they get admitted and they get to stay for a day or so and rack up a bunch of tests. And it's kind of like a hotel room check-in for them, but seen that a lot too.
Yeah, I think for the most part we're all on the same page with the doctors and the nurses.
They're all pretty quick.
There was a lawsuit though. There was an incident at I don't know which hospital. It was in Chicago, and it was in the emergency room, and there's a nurse suing because the officer just didn't.
Yeah, they settled that case.
Did they settle that?
Yeah, they settled it.
Oh, that was interesting. I was wondering, that's going to happen someday.
But none of us really know. It got reported in the news.
I didn't get it. What did the guy
do? I believe it was Cook County Hospital, and an officer was a protocol to a DUI, I believe. I don't even know the facts of this case. But anyway, what I know about it is that they were supposed to draw blood for a DUI, and the nurse refused. And by law, the officer has to have, and by law, the nurse is supposed to draw the blood. She didn't. I believe the officer handcuffed her, told her he was going to arrest her for obstruction, which would be a proper charge if those are the facts. But the officer declined and took the handcuffs off. And I don't think I don't think that's a huge damage.
It's not a typical case at all.
No, that was not.
There's always
going to
be conflicts in those situations eventually.
All right.
Well, thank you, ma'am. Very interesting contribution.
Okay.
Glad to have heard from you. And we go directly back to Martin Pribe, to Brendan Dougherty, to John Wrigley, all working officers of the Chicago Police Department. And Chris has joined us at WGN. Good evening.
Hi, gentlemen. Excellent show. I just would like to point out that I'm currently a dispatcher. I take 911 calls and dispatch the field units for Chicago currently. So some of the stuff that the gentlemen are talking about has hit home. I've been doing this for over 10 years. And with regard to the comments about the lack of support, one of the things that I've noticed here with 10-plus years is the evolution of expectations for what the citizens believe the police can and should provide. When I first started taking the calls here in Chicago well over 10 years ago, we were given a lot of liberty in which to tell the people who were phoning that such and such was not a police issue and that they'd be better off going a civil route or some other mechanism or some other agency that may handle a dispute. That has changed over the years, in my view. And we've unfortunately gone to a system now where the customer, as we're being told they're called now, are to be treated as clients, specifically that they are taxpaying clients, and that when they call, no matter how frivolous or trivial or in some cases just downright ridiculous their claims are, that we're to send the police. And that presents, I think, a unique challenge, because then the police are not focused on what the real problems are. That's the first thing, and I'll make the second half real brief. The other part of it is that now when we take 911 calls, I have been noticing a trend in a lot more requests for supervisors, mm-hmm. a lot more requests for people who are calling to complain about the police. A lot of times people are calling for the number for these OPS agencies. It's now some other name, but they are no longer willing to let an investigation or the police go out and do their job before they're already phoning back wanting a sergeant. They want somebody to tell on. They want to report something. And that trend has increased dramatically.
You mean they want to report a complaint against a police person?
That's correct. And here at the 911 center, we have a lot of technology, and sometimes we can actually see live feed of a particular area, not for every call, but for certain parts of the city, we are actually queued in to look at the street, and we're able to tell immediately from whether or not somebody's telling the truth. If we get one of those particular calls where we have live camera feed. And one of the problems is that people lie often when they call, or they exaggerate, or they don't have any real idea of what they're calling about. But yet, as call takers and dispatchers, we're supposed to take that information, then turn it over to the police, have the police do something with that.
There's a lot there. Let's get some response.
I think all those comments are very well said and articulate, and you know, it's frustrating when you know people are saying that the person had a gun just to make the police get there faster. And, you know, a lot of times cops are racing to these calls where people are, you know, not telling the truth. And, you know, cops are putting risk for car accidents. So I think the caller's comments are well said, and I appreciate them.
I agree with her. I think she made some very good valid points. Thanks.
No, absolutely. She made some valid points, and I think our industry is a lot like some of the other industries in our society, where civil liability has affected the way we respond to things. Civil liability obviously has affected the way she takes phone calls.
So you need some modification of tort law, too, just as doctors do.
Specifically, I don't know what that would be, but I think it civil liability, as far as how we do our job, has definitely put an effect on it.
Well, our thanks to the caller for a useful contribution. Here's the other side of the picture. I read an email. How did your guests react to the now infamous video of Officer Anthony Abate? Is there a point where good cops acknowledge a cop is bad and exclude him or her from the Brotherhood? Or is membership in the Brotherhood and support of a fellow officer unconditional? Remind our listeners who Abate is.
Tony Abate beat a bartender after a night of binge drinking.
A female bartender.
Female bartender. And is now, I believe, going to jail for failing. I believe he failed part of his probation condition.
There was a full video record.
Yeah, there was a full video. It put a real black eye on the police department. It really did. It made us all look foolish. And
but you see what the caller is asking.
Yeah.
Are you all still loyal to him?
We are absolutely not. No. No, I haven't heard anybody support that.
No, the video is absolutely disgusting.
It is.
To not only the public, to police officers who have seen that also. And I would think if he was being completely honest with himself, he would also say that his actions that night were absolutely disgusting.
And I would like to add that I've never heard one cop who wasn't thoroughly disgusted by that video. And I would agree that it was appalling.
Sure. And here's Dave at WGN Radio in Chicago. Good evening. Hello, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
It is time to proceed.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay.
I wonder if you have anything to say.
I wanted to see what their opinions are on lifting the handgun ban in Chicago.
Yes, well, of course, we've got a number of emails raising the very same question.
I am against lifting the handgun ban in Chicago and everywhere else in the United States. From what I know of handguns, to carry one takes a lot of knowledge and training that as the general public you will not receive if you start carrying a handgun. And I'm not just talking about how to use a handgun. I'm talking about when to use a handgun and what situations and what you could be liable for if you misuse that handgun.
Here's an email on the same thing. Your newscast alluded to the impending Supreme Court decision on Chicago's handgun ban. Do your guests have any feeling about the best of what the best outcome would be? Not so much from the perspective of constitutional theory as from that of law enforcement policy.
I really don't. I've heard good arguments on both sides, and I really just don't have a strong opinion about it. I don't know. I see pros and cons. What do you guys think?
You know, I'm with Wrigley on this. I don't in the city, having more handguns out there is going to be a bigger problem for the police officer, and then the constitutionality of it is a completely different subject.
There are those, I'm not necessarily one of them, but I've had them on this program, who argue that to get rid of handgun bans, to have handguns available, what do you call it when, what do you call the law that allows you to carry them?
Conceal. Conceal and carry.
Conceal and carry, exactly, which they do in Texas and various other places.
Many other states, too.
That there are data that actually demonstrate that reduces crime rates.
But that's a different culture. Chicago is a different culture.
Explain.
You know? And, well, we're different people, and we're not, born and raised hunters, I think, for the most part. I don't think that we, as Chicagoans, look at concealed carry the same way as somebody down south would.
But their slogan runs, if guns are criminalized, only criminals will have guns. And
there's a truth to that, yes. Absolutely.
I think, number one, you can find a statistic to support any claim.
True.
So I wouldn't put a whole lot of weight into that. Secondly, I think any law-abiding citizen should have the right to own any gun he wants to. I think as far as when you can carry it concealed, definitely should be limited, and especially in a major city where there is violence and gangs.
Yeah.
And it's a very complex issue, more complex than most people realize.
More complex than we can resolve tonight.
Absolutely.
Here's Jim, who's joined us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Good evening. I just wanted to comment. I'm a 15-year veteran of the police department. I work in Cook County, but not for the county. I really don't want to say the municipality that I work for. And I came in on kind of the tail end of the conversation before you started taking calls, so forgive me if I repeat something that your guest had said. But over the course of the 15 years, I've noticed a trend in which not only are we fighting the judicial system, which includes judges, which in a lot of cases I feel are not qualified and either appointed to the bench or elected to the bench because of political affiliation, and state's attorneys who are probably not the most qualified in the world, or you also have the issue of with the felony review process where attorneys do not want to approve felony charges that are anything less than rock solid because their peers who are in the felony trial rooms are evaluated by their conviction rates. But the biggest thing that I've noticed is that the command staffs, not only for my department, but in the area, have become so scared of being held responsible in civil court for the actions or inactions of their officers that they no longer make decisions on good police work, and they're more risk management now. In my particular department, we are encouraged not to do consent searches on vehicles anymore. And when I first started the job, that was a big part of it, was get out there and make traffic stops and see what you can dig up. Now, that's no more. And I think a lot of that has to do with the racial profiling study that was enacted by then the state Senator Barack Obama. We have limitations on pursuits where not that long ago, we had a violent felony that took place in our town in which two offenders were armed with shotguns, and the vehicle was located in the area. Officer tried performing a felony stop on it. The vehicle took off, and we had to terminate any kind of efforts to stop the vehicle because we're not allowed to chase anymore. And, you know, just like the concealed carry issue, the pursuit issue is not something that's going to be resolved or even come close to discussing all the complex angles of it within a period of 2 hours, But I do think that at some point in time, the pursuit is a necessary evil. And it's just, it seems like, particularly in my agency, the command staff, instead of being, wants us, instead of being proactive, to become reactive and almost act like the fire department.
So it's a lot of good material there. Let's get some response.
I think he brings up some great points. You know, the Chicago withdrew their pursuit policy years ago. I don't mean withdrew. We stopped it. It is strictly for fleeing felons. And some points, you know, you don't need to get into a car chase over traffic. Other points, you do need to get into a car chase to get somebody who's committed, someone who's a fleeing felon who will hurt somebody else or has the potential to hurt somebody else.
I think those were very articulate, well-said comments. I would say that we were talking earlier about the cameras and this in-squad cameras. Police in Chicago are really under a lot of scrutiny, and I think that there should be. I think some of the scrutiny wouldn't be a bad idea to spread into other aspects of the of the law enforcement and legal system in the city.
Be more explicit. What do you what do you have in mind?
That, well, I mean, you know, there should be some means of accountability for all public institutions, especially those that deal with law enforcement and the judicial system. I think there's an awful lot on us, and I would, as a caller said, I'll just leave it at that.
All right.
Like we made the point earlier, civil liability has changed a lot of industries in the United States or in our society, and law enforcement is one of them. A lot of the decisions that he's alluding to as far as command officers or any general orders that come out with a department revolve around liability towards the department and to the city that the department serves.
A reaction to a settlement.
Reaction to a settlement. So it has become very complex. And as a citizen who, you know, is not in law enforcement, it probably seems as though it's needed. And it is needed. A lot of it is needed. I think a lot of ways police have shot themselves in the foot in some incidents, and that has brought about the civil liability also. But also there's overreaction, and it dictates, like you said, it dictates how we do our job, and sometimes it limits how we do our job.
All right, thanks to the caller. Very valuable contribution. We return to John Wrigley, Chicago police officer, Brendan Dougherty, Chicago police officer, Martin Pribe, Chicago police officer, and an author of one fine new book, The Wagon and Other Stories from the City, that about to be published by University of Chicago Press. You're going to stay with policing the rest of your life? You're going to be a successful, well-known author?
That's a question. A part of me would love to just be a full-time writer, and a part of me would like to stay with the job. I have a lot of I've had some back problems, so that I don't know. I'm drawn both ways. I wouldn't mind being a full-time writer. I would like to, at some point, be a full-time writer.
You got off an interesting comment that the way to write about Chicago, and particularly about crime and so on in Chicago, is not in novels, but in real nonfiction stuff like you've got in your book.
I always felt that I have a presumption or a pretense that the. I always felt Chicago did not, to write about the city and make it a main force in some writing, the novel didn't work. I just felt that way and struggled with that for a long time. And so I in writing about this book, I've discovered a sort of nonfiction way to, mm-hmm. although I do feel like I tried to move some elements of fiction into the writing and the storytelling and development of character and pacing and whatnot. So, but yeah, I think that, Chicago is a place that sort of requires its own form, much like Whitman's New York required its own free verse and that he finally got a hold of. I think that's the way Chicago is.
Well, it's a very vivid book, and it's very engrossing reading. It's artfully constructed.
Thank you.
And but can people buy it right now, or do they have to wait for 2 weeks?
They can order it online at Amazon or the University of Chicago Press, and it should be out in 2 or 3 weeks.
I've got a copy already, so.
You got a galley copy, yeah.
It exists.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the name of that book, if you haven't caught on yet, by Martin Pribe. Pribe is spelled P-R-E-I-B. The name of the book is The Wagon and Other Stories from the City. And we go back to the city or wherever and back to the phones And here comes Tom. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Yes, sir.
I would just like to thank these officers for taking some time to sit down with you and answer these questions. I find it very difficult to answer questions from my family and friends regarding my job.
You're another cop, I gather.
I am. I have 2 years on, and I'm at work right now, so you'll have to excuse me if I get a call. I might have to go immediately.
Sure.
But I get a lot of questions that I can't seem to find the answers for, or can't word it the way a layperson would understand, and so I really appreciate how your guests tonight articulated themselves and answered your questions. I can't think of many other jobs that people think they know so much about when really they have no comprehension of how difficult, deep the job and difficult the job can be. So I really just want to, I really appreciate you guys and the work that you do.
What have you found most difficult about the job?
I guess it would be like turning it off when you go home. I don't know, I'm sure your guests can agree, when I walk into a room and I'm off duty, as soon as I walk in a room, I'm looking at people's hands. We're taught in the academy, hands kill. And unless you're dealing with Bruce Lee, someone's not going to kill you with their feet or any other part of their body. So you're constantly studying people's hands, watching where they're reaching. How I talk to people off duty, I kind of have to realize that I am off duty. And
and you're not interrogating.
That, or, you know, I don't have the authority that I would at work.
Yeah.
So I find that intrinsically difficult.
That's fascinating. Does this check out?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Absolutely. I was,
thanks, Tom.
I was telling,
yes.
I was telling Marnie the other day, my fiance was complaining that I often interrogate her. When they're simply just, in my opinion, questions that I have about her day or whatever the case may be. But it is hard to, turn off. And I believe he said he had 2 years on. And, you know, as he grows in his career, he's going to learn how to deal with it better and turn it on and off, and and probably develop a sense of humor about it and laugh about it when he goes home.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll do fine. It's you'll find your niche. You'll use it. It'll work for you. Hopefully it's a positive one. Mm-hmm. You know, mine's music on the way home. It takes my mind off of it.
But what about the angle about watching hands? Meaning remaining suspicious about the people around you.
Yeah, hands deliver the weapon, if it's a gun or
Do you find yourself like this caller?
Not anymore.
Checking people out that way in social situations?
No, but I'm always suspicious of when people are talking. There's always a voice in my back of my head saying, is that for real or is this guy lying? Is that, you know, I'm much more suspicious, incredulous.
And that's a cop's thought, is it?
I think so.
I think when you're suspicious of everyone most of your days, it's hard to turn that off. And yeah, I do find myself checking people out in a bar, you know, when they walk in the bar, looking them up and down. I still do that. And I've got 15 years on the job also.
You know the old B.B. King blues? My mama says she loves me, and she could be jiving me, too.
Yes.
No, it's nobody loves me but my mother, and she could be jiving.
That's a proper title, yeah.
That's a great album.
It is.
It's one of my favorite albums.
Yeah. Yeah. But your suspicions don't extend to your mother.
Oh,
No.
They it might come off that way to them. But like I said, every police officer develops his own way of dealing with the job, and especially when they go home and they learn how, and I've learned how to turn it off and on. And I think any seasoned police officer, with a good attitude learns how to do that properly.
Last question, almost out of time. Is there a police show that is really realistic? In that?
Hill Street Blues, long gone.
The old Hill Street Blues, had it right?
Had it right.
That's the one I quoted earlier. Yeah.
Uh, I don't know. I like Law and Order. I don't think it's necessarily real realistic.
Yeah, it's TV, so you have to entertain. And this job isn't always entertaining. But yeah. I like the new show Southland. That kind of hits some points that are absolutely true.
Gentlemen, I thank you most sincerely. It's been a fascinating evening. And our three guests, to quickly reintroduce them even as we say goodnight. John Wrigley of the Police Department, Brendan Dougherty the same, Martin Pribe the same, and the author of a fine new book, The Wagon and Other Stories from the City, which can be purchased on the Internet from either Amazon.com or from University of Chicago Press.
The preceding was a production of 720 to Go.
For over three decades, Milt Rosenberg has been feeding your head. Get a mindful on Extension 720 on 720 WGN.